I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. Good evening. North Korea, a rogue failed state in the hands of predators with nuclear weapons and ballistic missile, three-stage ballistic missile now successfully tested as a weapon of war, as a predator tool. Gordon Chang of Forbes.com is traveling in Asia under the threat of the North Korean predators and their Iranian customers. He is in on Taiwan, and we're joined by Rick Fisher, who is a senior fellow at the Asian Military Affairs at the International Assessment and Strategy Center. And Rick, a very good evening to you. I begin because this is some days since the North Korean test. What surprised you about this test, and what is significant to you now going forward in measuring North Korea as a threat? Good evening to you, Rick.
Good evening, John. Thank you again for having me on. What is surprising is that it actually worked, that after three attempts that they would actually put a satellite into orbit, a wobbly orbit, unsuccessful orbit, but all augurs well for North Korea to be developing a nuclear-armed ballistic missile that can reach the United States. When will this happen? Estimates range out to perhaps 5 years. I would think sooner, especially if China helps them to design a new liquid fuel or possibly solid fuel ICBM that we saw revealed in mock-up or model form this past April.
Gordon?
Rick, when you talk about past April, on April 15th in Pyongyang, we saw six Chinese mobile launchers. And on top of them, as you point out, there were six missiles. You have stated that China has sold these mobile launchers and these missiles to Pakistan. What do you think is the possibility that China actually sold those missiles to North Korea this time?
Very good, Gordon. In order to design the truck to carry those missiles, you have to know basically everything about that missile. So the company that makes the trucks that North Korea uses is more famous for making solid fuel missiles, and sold an intermediate-range solid-fuel missile to Pakistan so that they would do the same for North Korea, ought to occur to people who should be concerned.
And many people say that the rocket that was launched a couple weeks ago isn't really a military threat because it has to go up in the pad 2 or 3 days, got to be fueled, can be destroyed by a plane with a missile. But with these mobile launchers, it makes it very difficult to find North Korea's rockets, missiles. Wouldn't it be very, very difficult for us to do that as a practical matter? And effectively, this would give North Korea the means to strike the United States with an effective weapon?
Absolutely, Gordon. A mobile missile on the big 16-wheel TEL that we saw in April can be put in a cave hangar or a no-descript building hangar and wheeled out under camouflage and launched before we can react. But even the development of a non-military space launch vehicle is destabilizing. I would point out that in 1995, North Korea sold Scuds to Peru. Well, 15 years later, Chile and Brazil want to develop their own space launch vehicle. Might they go to North Korea? And if Chile gets an SLV, might Peru want a bigger missile? And where would Peru go? Having already received a North Korean missile, maybe they could get a bigger one.
Implicit in your list of states interested in a mobile missile launcher, implicit in this is proliferation, not just of ballistic missiles, but also of NBC. That's the nuclear, biological, chemical, the warheads that make ballistic missiles frightening globally. And, Rick, I mentioned because later on tonight I will speak with Paul Bracken, his new book, The Second Nuclear Age. I want to push this point at both you and Gordon. What I learned from Professor is that it is not useful any longer to continue to deny the facts that nuclear weapons and ballistic missiles are in the hands of renegades and will continue to be passed around to nationalist leaders who are not intending to keep the peace but threaten their neighbors and blackmail. That is a fact. And therefore, North Korea is not atypical, Rick. What we're dealing with is the 21st century. North Korea and all these other states that are dealing with it are the new threat, and we're not going to stop them. Do you accept that right now, Rick?
Well, I don't want to, but our supine governments, especially the current administration, is doing nothing, John, and the American people are not being served. I would certainly hope that the professor would be in favor of identifying and going after far more aggressively the sources of this currently proliferating and to be much more profoundly proliferated technology. And by that I mean we have to go after China. China has its finger, its hand, and its arm in North Korea's, Iran's, and Pakistan's nuclear and missile programs. And we simply have to go to the Chinese and say, enough is enough. If you can't take all this stuff back, we're going to organize against you. That would be step number one. And step number two, we're going to arm our friends to defend themselves from your missiles, China, and North Korea, and Pakistan, and Iran.
Gordon, an arms race. Do you accept it?
Well, there is an arms race, and there is because, as Rick points out, this administration and the one before it has done relatively little to stop the North Koreans when we actually had the means to do so. And if we continue to have a very relaxed attitude towards what's going on with regard to China, Iran, North Korea, this is going to be a very difficult world for us and for our friends.
But accept that it is. We're there already, Gordon. It's not coming on. Do you accept that? That North Korea is selling to customers, and those customers, we can name states. You've named some of them. On my list is Zimbabwe, for example. All of these states see advantages to possessing nuclear weapons and possessing ballistic missiles or trading in the technology that would lead to it. And accepting that, Gordon, I think is the first challenge in the second nuclear age.
John, I would also point out that our friends are already in the missile business. Japan is now developing its second generation solid fuel space launch vehicle, a.k.a. IRBM. South Korea is trying to launch its first liquid fuel space launch vehicle, a.k.a. IRBM. Taiwan wants a space launch vehicle. Vietnam, Australia, other friends might not be soon to join that list.
Gordon?
Well, you know, we talk about South Korea, which had a rocket which was on the launch pad, and was taken down and will be fired off sometime next year. So as John points out, it is a fact that this technology has been proliferated. It's been proliferated by China, and now it's very difficult for the United States to do anything about it. So, Rick, what was the first thing that you would do if it were President Fisher and you had the opportunity to pick up the phone to Xi Jinping, the Chinese leader, and tell him what the United States was going to do?
Well, I would say, look, you have a choice. You can take back your nuclear and missile technology from the states for which we will give you a long list of, or your 157,000 students studying at our universities to build your future are going to go home within a month.
Rick, just a detail here. The Non-Proliferation Treaty is a document from the 20th century that was written by the monopolist set of the major nuclear powers, the United States, Britain, France, the Soviets, too, and China. Those five powers wrote, and they're all on the Security Council. That NPT no longer has meaning to the proliferation of nuclear weapons or the ballistic missiles accompanying it.
Well, it has meaning for them stopping our proliferation, of course. They never had any intention to stop their proliferation. It was aimed at us.
Right. But the new states coming on, they're not going to obey the NPT.
And therefore, I think we're at
a moment now, and I'm inviting everyone to think about this. Rick is a professional, Gordon's a professional, but you're all welcome, because here you are, citizens of the 21st century. The bipolar world, the Cold War, It was a fiction. It was a multipolar world, I understand. But here we are in the 21st century. And what we watch in North Korea is not a bad boy who will be corrected in time, but is representative of the future. Rick Fisher of the International Assessment and Strategy Center, Gordon Chang of Forbes.com in Asia. I'm John Batchelor. I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show in Asia with Gordon Chang of Forbes.com, who's on Taiwan. And we're joined now by another of our colleagues in Asia, Greg Scarlatu, who is the executive director at the Committee for Human Rights in North Korea, in Seoul, in South Korea. Greg, a good morning to you and in North Asia. And I begin with the political breakthrough, a woman president elected in South Korea. She will take office in the new year. She is the daughter of a former president slash dictator, President Park. And working with human rights, especially in the long, long march to resolve the depravity in the north and dealing with the sensitivity and the reluctance and the denialism that you've documented on this show in the south, what do you anticipate with President Park in dealing with the North with regard human rights? Good morning, Greg.
John and Gordon, and an honor and a privilege, gentlemen. President Park Geun-hye is certainly the daughter of the late president and dictator Park Chung-hee, who did a lot of great things for the South Korean economy, but didn't exactly have a stellar record when it came to human rights. So I think that as part of his daughter's legacy, she will need to pay attention to this particular issue of human rights in North Korea. And I also think that a very positive first step would be to pass the North Korean Human Rights Act in the South Korean National Assembly. Mrs. Park Geun-hye, the conservative candidate representing the Saenuri Party, the New Frontier Party, has won the presidential election. The Saenuri Party also has 152 seats, a majority in the South Korean National Assembly. So I think that we're in a position where we might be able to see finally a North Korean Human Rights Act in South Korea. Of course, we've had one in the United States since 2004. There is also a North Korean Human Rights Act in Japan as well.
Gordon?
Greg, do you think that the new South Korean president, Ms. Park, is going to get support from the United States if she has this initiative on North Korean human rights?
I think that a lot of experts and also government officials may have breathed a sigh of relief in Washington, knowing that Mrs. Park has won the elections. It is very likely that we will continue to see a very strong U.S.-Korea alliance. It is very likely that we will see U.S.-Korea coordination when it comes to dealing with North Korea. And if a positive initiative regarding North Korean human rights became apparent on the part of Mrs. Park Geun-hye, I see no reason why the United States shouldn't follow suit. Of course, Mrs. Park Geun-hye has signaled her intention to engage North Korea in some shape or form, which would be different from the policies of her predecessor, President Lee Myung-bak. However, his reluctance to continue the previous policy of engagement was the result of North Korea's provocations, beginning with the killing of a South Korean tourist in the summer of 2008.
Greg, you have told me that Mrs. Park is 60 years old and the daughter of a former president dictator, and across the line is Kim Jong-un a mystery, an enigma, the third son roly-poly and not well-educated in what you'd say is statesmanship. So what does this relationship look to the people of the South? Are they smiling? Do they shrug and say, well, anything can happen?
I am smiling right now, John, just thinking of a summit meeting between Mrs. Park Geun-hye and Kim Jong-un. Mrs. Park Geun-hye is a 60-year-old South Korean lady. Kim Jong-un is a 28 or 29-year-old man from North Korea. There are certain cultural difficulties that that would be involved in a summit meeting, and it would be very hard for Mrs. Park Geun-hye to observe the etiquette that the North Koreans might expect during such a summit meeting. So the circumstances are indeed very special. The first woman president in South Korea, 60 years old, meeting with this very young new leader of the North.
Gordon?
Greg, you know, it's not just a question of a very young North Korean leader and a 60-year-old South Korean. It's really North Korea and South Korea. You know, North Korea is one of the most horrific states on earth, probably the worst. And South Korea is a liberal democratic nation moving forward on so many different fronts. It would seem to me that the conversations would be very difficult regardless of the leaders of these two states just because of the nature of both South Korea and North Korea, don't you think?
Absolutely, Gordon. It would be very difficult. And even if one wanted to move some type of engagement forward, first of all, nobody should be in a rush because the North Koreans have just engaged in a very serious military provocation, the apparently successful launch of a three-stage ballistic missile. And certainly there are UN Security Council resolutions in place. It was made very clear that claiming that this was a satellite launch and not a ballistic missile launch would be a violation of UN Security Council resolutions 1874 and 1718. And so this is one difficulty. The other difficulty is the actual implementation. Remember that the North Koreans, for example, have confiscated the assets of Hyundai Asan that used to run for 10 years an operation in North Korea, South Korean tourists going to North Korea on tours. So if one were to resume this operation, how do you do this? Is Hyundai Asan going to buy their own hotel back from the North Koreans? Are the North Koreans just going to give it over to them, turn it over to them just like that? So the actual implementation of any type of engagement would be extraordinarily difficult. And by all means, concerns, serious concerns about the egregious human rights situation in North Korea should definitely be included in any type of attempt to approach the North Korean regime.
Greg Scarlatu is the executive director at the Committee for Human Rights in North Korea. We emphasize this is a brave new world. Congratulate the South Koreans coming from a dictatorship and a brutality 60 years ago through dictatorships and doubts in the late 20th century, now electing the first leader, female leader, for the Korean Peninsula, Mrs. Park, and her success is South Korea's and democracy's success as she faces the predator rogue state of North Korea. Gordon Chang of Forbes.com is on Taiwan. I'm John Batchelor. I'm John Batchelor. My colleague and friend Gordon Chang is traveling in Asia. He's in Kaohsiung, which I'm told is a very large city in southernmost Taiwan, the free capitalist democracy of Taiwan. He was speaking recently in Taipei, and we are now speaking of Burma, a new, and we have reason to believe, liberated or moving towards liberation state that was recently in the grip of brutes, of goons, the junta. Kelly Curry is the senior fellow with the Project 2049 Institute. Kelly returned from Burma some months ago, and she told us when she first got out, this is when it was called Myanmar, that everybody was going in. Well, I hadn't considered that everybody included the one, the only BBC News TV channel returning to Burma. Kelly, this looks like a celebration, not only because the BBC these days needs all the friends it can get after the recent, let's put it this way, unhappy news about how it tolerated abuse back home, but also because the BBC was Burma. Burma was the BBC once upon a time. This return, what does it mean for the Burmese people or for the Burmese government? Does it mean all's well, or is this a fragile period where they're going to test each other out about scrutiny and transparency? Good evening to you, Kelly.
Good evening, John and Gordon. I think that it's a good step. It's a positive movement on what's been a fairly positive trajectory on media liberalization in Burma over the past year, that we've seen several steps with the domestic press in Burma, where they've been subjected to less censorship and less scrutiny and more given more freedom, still not complete freedom, but more, and where foreign media has been given access to the country and allowed to report more or less freely. You now see foreign media reporting with their byline, whereas before they wouldn't put a correspondent's name for fear of having that person arrested. So you're seeing a step-by-step liberalization of the media in Burma that's both domestic and international, and this BBC presence that's being revived in Burma is certainly part of that.
Gordon?
Kelly, it's stunning to see the BBC in Burma. Are we in future months going to see CNN and Al Jazeera and the other big international media organizations set up shop in Burma?
Well, they've all been having correspondents reporting from Burma at various points over the past year, including during the president's visit and at other times. The international media has been flooding into Burma over the past year, and in a way that they haven't been able to. It used to be very difficult for journalists to get visas, and now they're not having problems at all. People who I know who were journalists who were on the blacklist have been taken off of it and are allowed to come in and report. So the international media is really is pretty unfettered in Burma these days.
And is that going to have an effect on the Burmese people and the way they view their government and society and the world?
I think probably the most important thing for them is the fact that the domestic press is just blossoming and has experienced this incredible renaissance where you have all these private magazines and newspapers that are very critical of the government, that report pretty much, they are not really subject to the same kind of censorship that they have been in the past, and they're reporting very critical articles and reporting about Aung San Suu Kyi and reporting critically even about her and reporting about various things that were not previously allowed. So you have a much much more open and growing media environment in Burma that is, in some cases, even exile media coming back in and setting up a presence, and people who were underground coming above ground now. It's really quite remarkable.
Kelly,
definitely one of the successful parts of what's going on in Burma right now.
Kelly, I read that the BBC's Burmese service has long been available, broadcasting from with shortwave from outside.
Yeah.
Really, it's something like the early 20th century here, shortwave.
Right.
But that, and it has a very large audience in Burma.
Uh-huh.
The question is, will it be permitted to broadcast in there on normal circumstances? Will there be no longer a filter here? What is the threat of Burmese service from BBC?
Well, I think that that's still being negotiated, is my understanding, for them to be able to broadcast from within Burma. For now, they're going to continue to broadcast on shortwave. And the United States has similar services, similar Burmese language services that it supports from Voice of America and Radio Free Asia that also have a very substantial audience inside Burma. And they are negotiating their own footprint there. The head of Radio Free Asia was just in Burma and just met with the president, Thein Sein, to talk about RFA's, you know, position in Burma. So you're seeing a real sea change in the media landscape in Burma.
This is
a real thing.
What can the Burmese BBC service do from outside that the BBC TV news won't do from inside? I'm not balancing this. I don't see the comparison.
Right now, the only broadcast media that's available in Burma is still state media. You don't have private broadcast media. You have private broadsheets and print media, but you don't really have private broadcast media right now that's not the state-run. So external services like the BBC, Voice of America, and Radio Free Asia provide and Democratic Voice of Burma, which is another one. These provide the only alternative broadcast media at this time.
Gordon?
Kelly, isn't the really important thing here not so much that the BBC will have a more established presence in Burma, but isn't this a signal throughout all of society, not just media, you know, not just democracy, you know, all of it, that basically the country has turned maybe not 180 degrees, but certainly has turned a well away from the path that everyone assumed it was going to continue on. And instead of darkness, we're going to have light and everything's going to be great. Isn't that where we're going? Or maybe I'm a bit too optimistic.
Well, there are certainly real changes going on. And the level of individual liberty that the average Burmese person is experiencing right now, and the government's control over the media has been diminished substantially. They're still there. They still have state-run media, but there are now lots of alternatives that are not subject to really – there used to be very, very severe censorship and real efforts, and it was illegal to listen to the radios, the external services like BBC and Radio Free Asia and Voice of America. Now it's not. You know, people listen to them openly, and so it's different for sure, and it's having an effect. People feel freer in this regard. It's certainly important. But there, you know, this is one of these things that it's a really important, but it's a necessary but insufficient condition for deeper reforms. And so I think you've got to see media laws that allow private ownership and really dismantle the censorship institutions and get rid of them completely, and different institutions that need to come into place now to make this sustainable.
Kelly, there must be worries about this. It went very well when the president and the secretary of state visited, but there are hesitations about where the hunt has gone and what's going on in back channels, and a long-term concern about where the Chinese, who are not friends of transparency. So what are your doubts, Kelly?
Well, I think that since the president's visit, you've seen a lot of backsliding, frankly, on some issues of major concern to the United States, including a very violent crackdown on a peaceful protest over a copper mine that's jointly owned by a Chinese munitions manufacturer and a Burmese military-owned holding company, economic holding company. And a protest there was very violently it was led by monks, and it was peaceful, and it was very violently put down by the authorities. And there have been a series of other incidents in the past month since the president's visit that have raised a lot of questions about whether that visit was premature and things are not quite as positive as people want to believe they are. So there are some real structural problems and ethnic nationalities and their conflicts with the central government, the situation in western Burma and the Rakhine State with the Rohingya. There are a lot of flashpoints in this country that are very deep and unresolved, and some of those superficial but very positive, very, you know, easy to see reforms, but unfortunately quite, you know, they're kind of the low-hanging fruit. And we're now starting to move on to some of the harder issues, and you're seeing pushback from the vested interests in the country. So.
Gordon, we have a minute.
Kelly, is this reversible?
Of course it is. Of course it is. Look at Mali. I mean, they were hosting the Community of Democracies 6 years ago, and now they're having a coup every other month, it seems like. So, of course, it's reversible.
And Kelly points to a sub-Saharan African state that is now fractured by some of the darkest hands in all of the world. We're talking about Al-Qaeda being opportunistic in a broken state that was held up as a model of Francophone Africa. And that's a hard comparison, Kelly, but the Chinese, Beijing, do they want this to happen, or are they standing back waiting to cause trouble?
They are waiting for it to fail.
Kelly Curry, being very blunt about the success of Burma and the president's visit and the Secretary of State's visit, is still a rosy scenario that exists. BBC TV News going in is also very good news in the 21st century. Kelly is a senior fellow with the Project 2049 Institute. Gordon Chang of Forbes.com is in Taiwan, traveling in Asia. I'm John Batchelor. I'm John Batchelor, Gordon Chang of Forbes.com, traveling in Asia on Taiwan, a capitalist democracy with strong law and order courts, and Joseph Sternberg of the Asia Wall Street Journal editorial page, the business editor on Hong Kong, in Hong Kong. And we're looking at a piece just up on the Wall Street Journal written by two of Joseph's correspondents, Andreas Laufs and Jonathan Isaacs. This is about unions on the mainland and the management of the Chinese Communist Party with the House Union in the face of the facts that Chinese workers in the large factories producing all the goods that have been the miracle of China want higher wages and better working conditions than they want them now. Joseph, a very good morning to you. As I understand it from your piece, there is hard bargaining going on out there. There's some real collective bargaining demands. And what does the Chinese Communist Party make of this? Are they allowing it? Are they about to suppress it? Good morning, Joseph.
Hi, John. The Communist Party is actually, surprisingly enough, starting to go along a little bit with some of the interests of workers in China. But for different reasons. So this is kind of a different story from what some people hearing that statement might think is going on. What we're doing here is combining the Communist Party's fears about social disharmony, rising protests, rising grievances against the party state, and also the Communist Party's goal of trying to rebalance the Chinese economy toward more domestic consumption, which means they're going to have to increase household incomes. And so one of the ways that they're doing that is this interesting change where the Communist Party, which controls all of the official workplace unions in China, used to actually use the unions as a tool to try to suppress worker wages by banning any kind of employee activism to push for more pay. Now they're changing that a little bit, so they're going to start putting more pressure on employers, including foreign companies, to increase pay and improve working conditions, but not too much. So it's an interesting balancing act they're trying to do right now.
Gordon?
Joseph, this initiative of encouraging unions and putting employees on councils that will have management functions, is this going to occur only in foreign invested enterprises, or are we going to see this across the board also in the state enterprises?
Well, I think we're very early into the game right now, so it's definitely too soon to say. But I think that, certainly if you look at what has already happened, they have been more willing to allow outright worker protests, things like strikes or the like, against foreign-owned factories. Certainly there is going to partly be this sense that these foreign, what they want to discourage in some respects is this business of foreign companies coming in and opening factories that will be low-wage workshops. In that respect, the foreign companies will be targets. But there is actually some scope, although it'll be harder for them politically, to try to get some large state-owned enterprises to start redistributing some of their big retained earnings stockpiles to workers in the form of higher wages. Now, that it's a little harder to go after your own than it is to go after the foreign companies. But it's going to be everyone, but probably very unevenly.
Yeah, precisely. This smells like it's an attempt to put foreign investors back into the box. You know, we've seen this since the middle of 2006, that the Beijing central government has been using a variety of tactics to undermine foreign competitors in China. And I would love to believe that the workers across China are going to be empowered in all enterprises, great and small. But it just doesn't fit in with history. And essentially what we're talking about here is giving state enterprises another competitive advantage, as if they needed more. This really, I think, reeks of Beijing attacking the foreigners.
The demand for higher wages and better working conditions in China. I want to connect this, Joseph, with the tragedy in Bangladesh, the fire, the deaths of more than 100, and the destruction, I mean, really, the damage of many, many families in poor working conditions, working piecework for some of the biggest corporations in America. My understanding is that the reason Bangladesh is now so popular to make your clothes is because you can get cheaper labor there, cheaper than China, I'm told. And that is part of the story of what's going on in China. The wages are going up, so they no longer get the piecework for Walmarts and Sears. That goes to Bangladesh. But is that a product of worker demand is the puzzle? Or was this a product of inflation in China or great expectations or the aging of the workforce? Is this a success for the workers, or is it an evolutionary process, Joe?
Well, I think that it can be all of the above, actually. I mean, you would naturally expect that as the productivity of Chinese workers has been increasing, which I think it has been in a lot of manufacturing areas, you would expect wages to go up. So it's not necessarily a bad thing that they're losing some of that low-wage, low-productivity manufacturing. What I think is interesting, going back to a point Gordon made talking about how you want to believe or hope that this would be worker empowerment, it isn't really that. I think this is, these labor measures are more a rearguard attempt by the Communist Party to try to, continue managing this upward move along the productivity and wage scale. So they really are caught in this balancing act. I'm not sure I would share Gordon's views about this being explicitly about punishing foreign companies so much as I think it is just the Communist Party getting nervous about whether they're going to lose control of the ability to set wages or worker conditions and trying to find ways that they can reinsert themselves into that process.
Gordon?
Joseph, you got your finger on the pulse on what's going on in China. We've seen wage increases, which you've talked about, and they've been far in excess of inflation or productivity. How are basically foreign investors looking at the wage situation in China?
Well, I think that, again, it really varies by industry. So there are some industries where manufacturing in China still makes a lot of sense. For example, if you're going to be selling your product in China, this was the rationale behind a lot of foreign auto companies starting to set up factories there. It makes a lot of sense to manufacture there. If you're doing certain kinds of products, it makes sense. If you're doing other products, it makes less sense than it used to. Garments are a perfect example of that, where you are starting to see a lot of movement out of China. I think that this points to the bigger problem for Beijing and the Communist Party, though, which is that the Chinese economy has become so complex. So many different industries, so many different value propositions in terms of each industry, whether it makes sense to be there, it's becoming harder and harder for them to manage. But, of course, the Communist Party will never be able to admit that. So they'll continue trying any way they can.
And, Joseph, I just want to summarize right now this managing that the Communist Party is doing. Can we take this as a good thing because they're making concessions, however inadvertently?
Well, I think a good thing would be to liberalize the labor market more in China, make it easier for workers to move to different parts of the country where the jobs are, and also get the Communist Party out of the business of negotiation between workers and employers. That should be a private sector responsibility for the two of them to work out. Will that happen in China? No. Would it help them? Yes.
Joseph Sternberg is the business editor of the editorial page of the Asia Wall Street Journal. The piece is up right now on the Wall Street Journal site by Andreas Laufs and Jonathan Isaacs, Unionism in China, the New Age. Gordon Chang of Forbes.com, traveling in Asia on Taiwan. A very good night to you, Gordon, and thank you very much, and a good morning to you, Joseph. This is John Batchelor.